all across Wisconsin from Civic Media. This is Up North News Radio. Real information, good conversation, unabashedly Wisconsin. Here's the founding editor of Up North News, Pat Kreitlow.
And he is welcoming you back to the second hour of Up North News Radio for this Tuesday, February 7th. Coming up this hour, the new House Republican committee dedicated to conspiracy theories, the deep state, Hunter Biden's laptop, horse dewormer as a COVID treatment, gas stoves, M&Ms, and now Chinese balloons. We will preview this week's opening act of this made-for-TV panel. And one of the first to testify before this new House committee is Senator Ron Johnson, surprising nobody. Also, Chad Holmes and the latest from our Civic Media station in Wausau, Bull Falls Radio. A reminder, the February 21st primary is 2 weeks from today, and I hold in my hand here the absentee ballots that my wife and I filled out this morning. We are each other's witness on the ballots. That the witness has the sign in the back of the envelope. Be sure you include the address for the witness. It's not that complicated. Just got to follow the directions. Get those mailed in, or go vote on February 21st. But in-person absentee balloting starts today at many of your local clerk's offices, but you need to check with your local clerk's office to find out what are the exact hours that in-person absentee balloting is allowed. If you don't know who that is, go to myvote.wi.gov, and you'll find a link there by putting in your address to tell you who your local clerk is and who they would be. So that's going out in the mail along with these Valentines that I have to send out to the grandkids here before the day is out. 844-967-2789 is the regular phone number for the studio for many of our Civic Media shows. And then just because we're special up here in the 715, we have a second phone number that you could use as well, 715-388-7155. It doesn't get you in line any faster. It should, but it's just there because, again, we're special, and we'd love to hear from you, you know, anytime from 7:15 onward as we talk about some of the day's news. We have a question of the week over at the Up North News Facebook site. On Facebook, search for Up North News, specifically Up North News WI, to make sure that you get to us. And we are asking folks to tell us what is uniquely Wisconsin about their love story. And I talked in the last hour about meeting, you know, the girl of my dreams at a bar on Water Street at UW-Eau Claire. That's a pretty Wisconsin love story right there. And what's your own connection? Maybe it's you met over cheese curds, you know, or something along those lines, or at a uniquely Wisconsin place. We'd love to hear about it. Our reporter Sharita Booker is putting the story together. So you could send something to her at Sharita. And our parent company is called Courier Newsroom. So her address is Sharita, Cherita, Sharita at couriernewsroom.com. Or you could just go to that post on Facebook and put something in the comments that tells us your own uniquely Wisconsin love story. If you had a Powerball ticket for last night and you did not buy it in the Washington state, I regret to tell you that you're going to have to start over again and go to work today, because one single ticket in Washington state took the whole ball of wax, the whole $754 million Powerball jackpot. Again, that's $754 million if they went for the annuity distribution over 29 years. Most people opt in for the one-time cash payment, and that's just a measly $407 million. So, guess you're going back to work. As we've done last Tuesday, we took a peek back at the Sunday shows. I want to do that again here for the state Supreme Court race. Everett Mitchell, the Dane County judge, one of the four candidates for state Supreme Court, was on Upfront from WISN-TV over the weekend. And Matt Smith asked him a couple of questions about his campaign, starting with the fact that one of the other progressive candidates, Milwaukee County Judge Janet Protasiewicz, it far outpaces him in terms of fundraising. And so Judge Mitchell was asked if that means, what does it mean that he trails in fundraising?
It says that I may not have a whole bunch of wealthy elite donors. It says that I'm on the ground and I'm going to depend on those ground votes. What I've said to a lot of people is that money doesn't equal votes. What it does the commitment that I have made in Dane County and throughout our state, I've planted seeds for all of the different places. And is that is what I'm, you know, focusing on right now, to be able to bring out those voters to be able to support, because they understand that justice is not just what you say, it's what you do. And I'm a doer, and I've been doing work that have benefited Wisconsinites and specifically those in our communities who felt the impact of my work, and they will show up at the polls for me.
And one of the issues in the race has been about abortion rights. There are the two conservatives, Jennifer Doro and former Justice Dan Kelly, who are almost certainly going to uphold the state's 1849 abortion ban. Mitchell and Protasiewicz certainly lean against it, as they state their values, and Judge Mitchell was asked about that.
What I want advocates to be able to know is, you know, my whole value system has always been that we respect those rights of those individuals in our community. Like, as long as I've lived, you know, the Roe decision has been the guidance for reproductive choice and reproductive health. You know, and just like, you know, those who say, well, you know, you're projecting what you may do. I said, no, we're criticizing rules of law and standards that we disagree with. Just like there may be a Supreme Court may have granted Plessy versus Ferguson, but that doesn't mean that I have to then accept separate but equal doctrine as truth in the way our society needs to run. So I think those who are listening to me should understand that part of my values have always been to support reproductive choice, but we also follow the rule of law, and we try to make sure that we are not tipping the hand of how we would decide, but are willing to be open and listening to the cases that come before us and the facts that would be presented at that time.
Again, Dane County Judge Everett Mitchell, one of the Supreme Court candidates. One more note on the Sunday shows, A.J. Byatpour is leaving Capital City Sunday at WKOW-TV, taking a job in Milwaukee. We just wanted to tip our cap and say just a fantastic job, and thanks for all you did, and wish you all the best on your new venture. We'll have more, including your calls, after this. You're up north. For our guest, Milwaukee Pat McBride. Bucks.
That's the name of our team, and we will win.
With an effort supreme, because they play basketball in a professional way.
We'll prompt you to say, go, go, fight, fight, and hooray.
Fight and hooray.
How we handle the
ball. Handle the ball.
That's a sign.
Swedish Orchestra. You know how many times I heard that, Pat?
I could not even fathom a guess, but when I read that in your book about, you know, what you thought of the first Milwaukee Bucks jingle, I had to go looking for it, knowing that you were coming on board. Pat McBride has visited with us once before, mentor to our good friend, Dr. Kristen Lyerly, who also joins us. Good morning, Kristen.
Good morning.
So glad to have you here at this very early hour, as you're taking care of other business today. When we met with Pat McBride, I had not read his book yet. And then for Christmas, Dr. Lyerly got me The Luckiest Boy in the World. It was, unfortunately, Dr. McBride signed it incorrectly. He signed it as The Other Pat, and it's pretty clear to me, if there's The Other Pat, it's me. You are the original, you are the real deal, and we are just very honored to have you here. The book, for folks that haven't heard us before, talks about, you know, Pat's childhood, which was not easy, with a couple of parents who were well-known reporters, but also, I hope you don't take offense to the term raging alcoholics, but it really seems to apply in this case.
Mm-hmm. And that's very apt description.
Yeah. And again, at the same time, and what you really get from this book is, these are people, obviously, they were very well-respected reporters, highly educated. They taught you all kinds of values, but they had this disease of addiction, which did some terrible things as well. And then you talk about your path toward becoming the Milwaukee Brewers' first ball boy, working for the Bucks and the Packers. And so people are saying, wait, Dr. Lyerly's here. We're talking about hometown health. What's that? We're going to do a lot of that in the next segment when we normally do hometown health. We'll talk about Dr. McBride and his career in public health, and, you know, what it means to have mentors, and the value of teachers, and, you know, even just a good neighbor or a good friend or something like that. But I did want to spend a couple of minutes here talking about those early days, those sports days. And let me start first with this. We just had LeBron James break the all-time NBA points record for scoring, topping Kareem Abdul-Jabbar. who was there at the court for part of the little ceremony when LeBron broke the record. Do you mind sharing a little bit of your thoughts on Kareem and some of the NBA stars of your day working in the Bucks locker room back when we were playing goofy fight songs like that one?
Well, I was really pleased to see the way Kareem handled that. It's the way he is. He's a highly intelligent, very classy person. People don't understand the kind of person he is. He's very shy and introverted, and he's not normally out there. He's 60 years as a social justice advocate for big causes. He's a writer of over 25 books. He was proud of LeBron because LeBron is a person that's given back to his community. And, you know, records don't mean that much to him. What means a lot to him is what he's accomplished. You know, over his lifetime, I think. And, you know, he's proud to be a parent and a grandparent and just like the rest of us, you know. When I was there, he was a winner. You know, he won at every level, you know, high school, college. The Bucks, you know, the Bucks were the first franchise to win a championship in their third year as a team. And it was Lou Alcindor and, of course, adding Oscar Robertson. You don't win without the great Kareem Abdul-Jabbar. He had actually changed his name in 1968, but he was unstoppable. I mean, he could have scored as many points as he wanted, but he was a great person and a great team player.
And you get into that when you're talking about, at one point in the book, those intangible qualities of leadership, that you can have all the basketball skills in the world and or anything else. I was about to say surgical skills, whatever the case may be. The skills alone don't necessarily make you a leader. In fact, the modern day version of that is Kyrie Irving was just traded from Brooklyn to Dallas. He is a cancer on every team that he goes on. And yet there he was talking about his leadership skills that he's bringing to Dallas. And he's highly skilled, but not a leader. You saw that, you know, firsthand. I would guess not just with basketball, but all the sports that you were involved in.
Yes. And I would tell you that, you know, look at the record of the Los Angeles Lakers right now. I mean, LeBron is a really great player, but and he's won championships, you know, he's won four championships. But Kareem was a champion at every level that he went to because he made everyone great around him. You know, when I was with the Bucks, Bob Dandridge averaged 19.6 points per game. And we had players that were drafted in the fourth and sixth round, like Greg Smith and Bob Dandridge and other players that Kareem made great around him because he was unselfish.
And then to take it to real life is where I was going to pivot to Kristen as well, because again, you had Dr. McBride as a mentor, but in your clinical work and of course in the surgical suite where OBGYNs are all the time, and my being married to one of those, we talk all the time about cowboys. You know, the surgeons out there that they know they have amazing skills, but holy cow, they can't they can't charm anybody. Shall we put it that way, Kristen? So you know the value that people should take into any workplaces. Don't try to get by on your skills alone.
Well, it's really true. You have to have the whole package. And some people are great mentors and some people are more like cowboys. But the truth is, every student needs a mentor. And as much as we try in medicine to pair people like a dating service with someone who's going to help them get to that next level, it really has to happen naturally. It has to be something that you seek as a mentee and something that you're willing to offer as a mentor. And in fact, just last week, I reached out to Dr. McBride because I was working with a medical student who a different medical student had connected me with. And I said, here are this guy's interests, and he seems really bright and motivated. Who should we connect him to? And through our little world of connections, it took us, 2 minutes just to write a couple emails back and forth to each other. But this could be a connection, if he makes the most of it, that could be incredibly fruitful for him. So really, it goes back to that thing that we're missing in the world right now, which is more connection, more care, more investment in each other.
Because that way you end up, if not in a professional Hall of Fame, then somebody's personal Hall of Fame. And I say that with a purpose. You have a chapter here called The Halls of Fame and Shame. Now, last time we visited, I hadn't read the book yet, and I asked for one example of somebody in the Hall of Shame, and you told a story, and I would just urge people to read the book to learn more. But you know, the reason for bringing this up is that as you look at it, there's people that you think are heroes because of what you see on the field, but they're not really great people. And then there's other people that they look a little intimidating at first, but then they turn out to be some of the nicest folks out there. And as somebody working in the clubhouse, as a kid, basically, I mean, you really got to, I think your head had to spin a few times that you thought somebody was going to be one way and they turned out to be the other.
You know, I was thinking the other day about how incredible it was to get a dugout ready, full of bats and helmets and everything, and put on the uniform of a visiting team, and then run out and kneel down in the on-deck circle next to Carl Yastrzemski or Henry Aaron or Frank Robinson or Harmon Killebrew, and look over and be in the stands and be like, you know, I'd get chills, you know. But what I tell people all the time is that what we learned in the locker room is it took 5 minutes to understand that it wasn't a player's statistics. It wasn't their points scored or their batting average or the number of home runs they hit. It was the way they treated us. And that's true in the world of medicine. I mean, you walk into an operating room or you walk into, you know, if a surgeon's throwing instruments or screaming at you or a mentor is yelling at you, you don't learn in that environment. You're just scared and you shut down. Viola Davis said the other day as she was being interviewed about her Grammy, you know, she became the EGOT, you know, Emmy, Grammy, Oscar, and Tony. Mm-hmm. She said, the way to be successful in life, it takes one person to believe in you, just one person that believes in you. And that's so important for young people to understand right now. That's what my book is about. One person believed in me, one. And that was the trainer of the Milwaukee Bucks. And it changed my life. And that's why I dedicated my life to young people at the medical school. That was so important to me to return to that medical school and help young people. So that was a lesson I learned inside those locker rooms. And I tried to convey that in my book. And so I encourage anybody listening that if you got an opportunity to help young people to reach out and lift them up, because, you know, when somebody like Harmon Killebrew was kind to me and showed up for my younger brother, my younger brother's life was changed by Harmon Killebrew as a young person. He was struggling. And now he's the Associate Dean of Public Health at Washington University. I mean, it's a story you can't make up.
No, and it says everything about you know, mentorship, and we'll talk more about that after the upcoming break here. But I wanted to get into one more thing that's somewhat sports related, because you talked about setting up the dugout for a game, and you're setting up the locker room. We have talked about that there are tales of professional sports in here. There's tales of alcoholism. There's values of journalism. The one thing I think we've kind of undersold in the book is the work that has to be done to set up these sporting events. Now, I have a son-in-law who is essentially an equipment manager with a Division I school. So I have a rough idea of what he does. But I appreciated it so much more after reading this book that anybody thinking about any kind of a career in sports should read this. Not that it's all, you know, translates to, you know, 2023, but certainly some of the values of it in wanting to set the table for, again, whether it's a locker room, a surgical suite, you know, your own office, wherever it is. I know how much, Dr. McBride, you appreciate the setup, folks, having been one yourself.
Yeah. Well, imagine being an 18-year-old kid and being in charge of the equipment for a professional basketball team.
Yeah.
You know, senior in high school, and I had to order all the uniforms and all the socks and everything. And my first road trip with the Bucks actually was to Green Bay, and I had all the equipment together and everything, and I thought I had everything done, and I forgot socks. And the team showed up, and we had no socks for Milwaukee Bucks, you know. And the team was out there warming up without socks, you know, so I had to quickly call a sporting goods store and bring socks. It was really, it was an important lesson. It, you know, the players were teasing me and giving me a hard time, and you're going to get fired. And, you know. God, but we got socks, and we made it. And, you know, after that, I'll tell you what, I developed checklists, which was really important to me as a future physician, because when I went into, you know, any kind of procedure, any kind of thing, and, you know, I became the director of a clinic when I came right out of residency, and, man, I had checklists.
Oh, you have to.
Kristen knows.
Kristen knows.
Don't go into a medical procedure without a checklist.
And when we come back, we're going to start by talking about all the times Kristen Lierley throws instruments around the operating room.
right.
More with Kristen Lierley and our special guest, Patrick McBride, coming up in just a bit. This is Up North News Radio for a Thursday.
Be proud of our Milwaukee Bucks. Go, Bucks, go!
We're joined now by Congressman Mark Pocan. Congressman, how are you?
Hey, very good, Pat. Glad to be here.
Well, glad to have you here. Now, when you flew with the president on Air Force One, first off, let's do the journey, and then we'll do the visit. How far in advance do you hear about something like that?
I think we first heard about it on Friday, but honestly, I don't think we were confirmed on Air Force One until about 7 o'clock last night.
Wow. So you had a little time to pack a bag.
Little. Emphasis on little. But, you know, it's a pinch-worthy experience. You know, here you are on Air Force One. You're sitting with a bunch of the president's staff, and I'm sitting next to President Terry O'Sullivan, the head of LIUNA, you know, International Union. You know, a president comes out, and you talk for 15 minutes, and some about the speech, some about policy, and then somehow we got to me growing up in Kenosha and American Motors, and we got talking about 60s cars. It was an interesting flight, but, you know, I have to admit, I mean, you know, it's one of those things you'll probably never forget, right, when you do a trip like that, you know, and have the opportunity to have the president come to your district after something as important as the State of the Union. It shows how important Wisconsin is. The fact that he came to a labor hall, especially for me as someone who is a strong advocate for labor issues and for workers, you know, it was extra special.
What do you think it is the significance that so far his economic plan and his message has been so much more inclusive of, you know, blue collar jobs, as well as we always talk about the tech economy? And look, Madison is a hub of the tech economy, and you know, there are institutes of higher learning here, but there's also a lot of things that have to be built. So what does that say about what this administration is planning for its economic blueprint?
Yeah, I'll tell you, more than I think any president that I've known, and this I guess is the third president, but you know, at that level, He is grounded with where real people are, right? You know, Barack Obama, I love many things about him, amazing orator, you know, a once in a century individual, but he surrounded himself with people from Ivy League colleges and thought that that was the way to govern. You know, Donald Trump, well, we'll leave it at that.
Good call.
But with Joe Biden, you know, what was interesting is, you know, he's very inclusive and very focused on things like manufacturing jobs. Because as we know in Wisconsin, not everyone is going to go take a tech job or do some of these other things. Not everyone goes to college, but everyone wants a good family supporting wage. And you can do that with a lot of different manufacturing and blue collar jobs. And, you know, our infrastructure was desperately needing an investment of money. And that finally happened after four presidents of both parties talked about it. Joe Biden got it done. But those are all good blue collar family supporting jobs. And he's really proud and loves to talk about that sort of thing. So I just think he's grounded with where real people are. He's not surrounded by a bunch of Harvard and Yale and Princeton eggheads. He's not surrounded by a bunch of people who just care about, you know, corporate donors to their party. He cares about real people because I think he's always been pretty connected as a politician.
Well, he sounds like a guy that, you know, took the train every day and, you know, talked to real people for all those years when he was in the Senate. How are things from the laborers' point of view, you know, labor overall, and then the laborers' union specifically, as you talk to the folks there? You know, what is their take on all this? Is there, you know, skepticism because, you know, politics is politics, or do they really have a positive outlook on where things are going between the infrastructure bill and the other things that have been in the Biden agenda so far?
So, you know, I had a lot of conversations, especially with the international president of La Yuna about this. Not only is the infrastructure bill, you know, clearly a number of trades are going to benefit quite well, people who work in the trades. And for 5 or 10 years, this work is going to be out there because of the bills we did last session. But the CHIPS Act, you know, even though the idea is to make chips here again, so clearly there's going to be manufacturing jobs around that. The construction jobs alone to build the facilities so we can build these in the U.S., is $50 billion worth of construction dollars that are going to be construction jobs right now. And then the rest of the jobs will be there for the future. So there's a lot to be very, you know, optimistic around on the jobs front. Clearly coming out of COVID, that was where the president, the White House's focus, as Democrats' focus was. And, you know, I think we've greatly succeeded in that area.
I'm going to This is the best I can do for a curveball looking at this legislative session, because I get that the easy answer to this question is going to be zero. But you heard the president make the pitch that let's do a little bit more together on this, that, or the other thing. Do you think there is anything that, you know, a year and a half from now, you say, surprisingly, we got this bipartisan thing done? Or are we really thinking zero based on the divide in Congress these days?
So you have to do a budget bill, right? So that's above zero.
There you go. Okay. But we've already taken the over. All right. Good job.
I don't know how much more I've got for you, Pat. The problem is Kevin McCarthy is not in charge of his caucus. You know, every member is essentially the speaker in waiting, because that's all it takes is one member to oust him from his spot. And because of that, you know, we saw it last night. We've seen it since this first month with them in charge. He's not in control of anything. And there are too many, you know, we thought the Adams family was funny as kids because you had Morticia and Uncle Fester and Cousin It. You know, they look like Main Street Wisconsin normal compared to this Republican caucus. And that's the problem, is there, it's going to be hard for them to find a lot of consensus.
Look, you've been there long enough. You know enough Republicans. You don't have to agree on things. You learned that in the legislature as well. I have to believe, even though obviously nobody's going to name names, I have to think you know one or two folks on the Republican side of the aisle that saw some of that conduct on Tuesday night. And if they didn't roll their eyes right at you, you could sense they were doing it on the inside.
Yeah, well, I'll tell you, I am spoiled in Congress because I serve on appropriations. And for the most part, the vast majority of Republicans on that committee are traditional Republicans like you and I used to serve with, who you can disagree with, but you can do it without being disagreeable, and you still have to get something done at the end of the day. So I don't have to go and watch Marjorie Taylor Greene say that $5 billion went to one elementary school in Illinois for COVID, when clearly it takes fourth grade math level to understand that wasn't correct, and she doesn't really comprehend that. I don't have to deal with Matt Gaetz and his slimy, you know, actions that he does. I don't have to deal with Lauren Boebert, you know, hugging a gun publicly every chance she gets. I don't have to deal with those characters. So I deal with people who actually we have to pass a budget. So one bill we have to get done. So I guess I'm kind of relevant no matter what, which is nice. But two, my day-to-day existence is significantly better than most.
It really is. It seems like every time we talk, I hearken back to your days in the legislature, but we always say as well that, you know, when you're on the Joint Finance Committee, there's only one bill that has to pass, the state budget bill. And so that's where a lot of the work gets done. So now you're in the center of all that work as well. I wanted to ask about, you know, Senator Tammy Baldwin has been getting, you know, attention for the Made in America initiatives, the Buy American initiatives, and the infrastructure bill. Obviously, that's a priority for you and everybody else as well. That's something that has been talked about for years. For that to now be a part of the infrastructure of the infrastructure bill, that this is what we're going to have. Is there substantial significance to Wisconsin in that kind of language being inserted?
Absolutely. So you know, the first person to stand up and applaud that was Tammy Baldwin, that line last night I watched, because we're at I was trying to watch people like Kyrsten Sinema to see if she stood with more with us or Republicans and a few other things. Tammy was the first person, and she's been outspoken on this and done a great job across the state on this initiative. You know, down in Beloit, now I lost Beloit in the redistricting, but there's a company, Fairbanks Morse, United Steelworker workers, probably about 500,000 employees, depending. They make big engines for ships. And what's really important is, you know, there was an order from presidents to build things in America, because, you know, I don't know if you want foreign technologies in a submarine, right? Or things that could be a problem. But the Coast Guard in particular, and some of the other Defense Department agencies, didn't always do that. They'd buy things outside. This president's been very clear. And Tammy Baldwin has been very clear in helping, I think, to get this message to that level, that, you know, we benefit the most when American workers are making things, and also for other reasons, from national security to a whole lot of other aspects, that just makes sense. So again, Joe Biden is really focused on jobs. He gets that, would love to have things made back here again, doesn't want us reliant on foreign countries from everything from oil to computer chips. And that's why you're seeing, I think, the initiatives that are being introduced with that lens.
And let's get to focus on your own, you know, priorities and values. Of all the things that you heard in the State of the Union and all the things that have gotten done over the past couple of years, where were your biggest applause lines, and what things would you like to see accomplished yet, if possible, in the budget bill, if no place else?
Well, I really did love him highlighting all the bills we did last session, because I don't think people really realize we did four major bills that will affect every single family. And any one session, one of those bills would have been the biggest thing we did. We did four of them. So I was glad he did that. For me, the biggest disappointment has always been that we didn't address childcare. It was part of his agenda, the Build Back Better agenda, trying to cap it at 7% of people's incomes. You know, if you're a couple making $100,000 and you've got a three-year-old in daycare here in Madison, that's probably about $15,600 a year coming to pay for that. If you were capped at 7% of the president's proposal, you would save $8,600 a year. Plus, he had the child tax credit, don't forget, during COVID, that he'd like to continue. That was another $3,600 or so. End of the day, $1,000 a month difference in your pocket as a family, so that you could go on a family vacation, you could put money aside for your child's education, you could be able to buy that camper or the snowmobile, or, you know, the luxuries that we like to have in Wisconsin as a middle-class family. And that would have been a game changer for a lot of people. And we've been told by employers the number one thing barring people from going back to work has been childcare. So it was my biggest disappointment we didn't get it done. But what I love is the president still as committed as he was from day one on that. And it's not a question of if we get it done, it's just when.
Well, exactly, because we saw the difference that those things made when they were part of pandemic relief. Mm-hmm. Now they're going away because Republicans wouldn't go along with extending or renewing some of these things. So essentially, they become goals for the next time around, things that you'll be telling voters about in a couple of years, saying, if you put us back in charge, we can get those kids out of poverty again.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And, you know, the child tax credit was one of the biggest ways to help get kids out of poverty. The other is the supplemental nutrition assistance program. And quite honestly, that's a small amount of money in the grand scheme of things to help kids. But, you know, again, those values, what you get with Joe Biden is about as authentic as you can possibly get, I think, from a federal level politician. You know, I think he really does care. He's really putting that agenda forward. And I'll never forget the first time I was in the White House, we had about a 2.25-hour meeting in the Oval Office, 10 of us with him, about his Build Back Better agenda. And for the entire 2.25 hours, he answered every question himself, because it was his agenda. And as you know, often as elected officials, we have very superficial knowledge and our staff have the deep dive. One question he had to go to his staff and get more clarification and deeper dive on. I was extremely impressed because as much as I have many issues I care about, when it gets to details, I often have to turn to my staff who have the deeper dive on those subjects. And he really had an amazing grasp on things.
All in all, the experience between Air Force One and the speech, Is this probably the high point of the next 2 years, given what the road ahead looks like? And if so, can you revel in that? Can you live off that for a while?
Yeah, I mean, definitely, it was great for this year. I mean, it's going to be interesting. My attitude is, one, you know, I can still work on the budget. I can still have some relevant work to do, and we'll get things done, which is good. The second part is, I totally see us taking back the majority of the House in 2024, and I'm going to be very focused right here in Wisconsin on the Supreme Court race in April. You know, if we can have the deciding vote be someone who's independent and fair rather than one of these conservative knee-jerk votes that we've had, you know, we shouldn't have an 1849 law on abortion. We shouldn't have to worry about labor law provisions, you know, being struck down by a court. We shouldn't have to worry about a gerrymandered map that where your vote doesn't count, sometimes depending where you live, in the same way as other people. And it could be a significant change for Wisconsin. So I've got a lot to keep me busy between now and April. I'm going to be really busy, focused on our majority in the House for 2024. And, you know, I think those things will pay off, and then we can get that agenda of the president's done.
Congressman Mark Pocan, thank you so much for your time. Glad it was a great experience, and we appreciate the update.
Yeah, thank you, Pat. Of course, appreciate it.
One, two, three, four!
Well, she was just 17. So the Beatles, I saw her standing there, was the B-side of I Want to Hold Your Hand, which I'm sure we played at least a couple of times during our This Day in Music History segment, so we went with the flip side. But plenty of folks were listening to that song as well. On this day in 1964, when it's fair to say Beatlemania really took hold in the United States. Thousands of screaming fans greeted the Beatles when their plane landed in New York, and they were getting set to come do the Ed Sullivan Show. And I guess I think the best oral history of that moment came from Billy Joel, of all folks. There is, on his Greatest Hits 1 and 2, the original CD at least, because that's what I have from way back in the day, he has an extra CD where he's talking to an audience. I don't know if it's at Madden Square Garden or elsewhere. And he talks about the moment that he knew he wanted to be a musician, a rock and roll musician. And that was watching the Beatles on Ed Sullivan. And he talks about the Beatlemania that had gripped the nation. And he reminds folks that this was only 3 months after President Kennedy had been murdered. And then his assassin was murdered on live television. And, you know, this was a time of great sorrow in the country. And about 3 months later or so, the country was looking for something new, some kind of a distraction, something to make them feel better. And along came all these young folks who were just screaming with joy at this new type of music. And as a result, Beatlemania really takes hold on this day in 1964, when they first landed in New York, the world went crazy for an afternoon. Also on this day, Laura Ingalls Wilder was born. This day in 1867. Actor James Spader is 63. Singer Garth Brooks is 61. And comedian Chris Rock is 58, which kind of surprises me. I did not think he was... some folks get old before I'm ready for them to get old.
Yeah, I was also surprised by that one.
Yeah. Let's go to the 1970s now. The number one hit on February 7th of 1970 was by Shocking Blue. And this is one of those times where I always like explaining to younger folks, my daughters and others, when they would hear the remake by, say, Bananarama. And I could say, no, that's a remake. And then, you know, play for them the original. Ashton Kutcher is 45 years old today. It was on this day in 1976 that Bob Dylan's album Desire hit number one on the charts. And then here's one of those, again, where I have to make sure Aaron isn't pulling my leg and throwing in something. But he says on this day in 1990, Primus released their first studio album, Frizzle Fry. Tell me more, Aaron.
Sure. I'll tell you a little more, and here's a clip of the song Too Many Puppies off of that album. again, it doesn't sound real, but... Primus, are you familiar with them at all?
No. Isn't that one of the Transformers? Oh, that's Optimus Primus or something. Yeah, anyway, tell me more.
But they're a band that thrives on being just plain weird. Very avant-garde. And I don't know. It's difficult to say anything about them besides just listening to it.
And look, I'm not in any way trashing that. I just got done telling you what young people in 1964 thought was new and novel and wanted to hear more of. And this was the case in 1990. And, you know, music styles change, as we're going to talk about with the Grammys as well. So thank you for a little bit of that education and for that little clip of what was the name of that song?
Too Many Puppies.
Too Many Puppies.
And we didn't get to the part where they sang, but they're like, Too Many Puppies. And so, yeah, here's who I want to hear do
the remake. Paul Simon, because he had a number one song this day in 1976.
The problem is all inside your head, she said to me. The answer is easy if you take it logically. I'd like to help you in your struggle to be free. There must
and
be
he'd sing, there must be a way to get rid of too many puppies or something.
That would be funny.
I would love that. I think that would be great. Also, this day in 1940, the second ever full-length animated film, Pinocchio, was released by Disney. And this is the anniversary of the dissolution of the Soviet Union, as the Central Committee of the Soviet Communist Party agrees to give up its monopoly on power, so the USSR went away on this day in 1990. For good? Not if Vladimir Putin has his way. It's always been a thing of his, is that he thought that the dissolution of the Soviet Union was essentially a treasonous act. And it has, you know, been a goal of his to put the Soviet Union back together by whatever means possible, and however many people, you know, men, women, children have to die along the way. In talking about the Grammys, I did mention in passing that when Harry Styles won Album of the Year, that raised a few eyebrows. And as I'm looking at some more of the post-game reaction, if you will, from the Grammys, there are quite a few people that are unhappy, shall we say, that Harry's House by Harry Styles won, because it won, they say, because it's popular. It's the same old, you know, pop music, and that the Album of the Year award does not typically go to artists who kind of push the envelope creatively, technically, and that's often done by artists of color. And, you know, a lot of folks thought that Beyonce should finally win it. And people were unhappy that in his acceptance speech, Harry Styles talked about something like how this doesn't happen to people like me very often. And he was talking about being a, you know, small town boy raised in Northern England, but other people saw that as, what, you know, white guy pop star wins Album of the Year? Yeah, that actually does happen before. And so there's a valid debate about that.
Yeah, and that's obviously not what he meant when saying that.
No.
Yeah, whatever you agree or whatever you believe should happen here. And I don't know. I don't have all the details. Maybe the album was really well produced and it is winning something, or winning that for some technical advancements that we just don't know about. But in general, I definitely do agree that we could use some more diversity in that spot.
It seems to be just in the Album of the Year category. And I don't know if it has something to do with, you know, who votes for that one or what, because while Beyonce didn't win that award, and yet again didn't win that award, she also set the record for the most Grammys ever won by anybody. And yet Chris Richards, the pop music critic for the Washington Post, his story was headlined, "Beyonce just made Grammy history. Why does it feel like she still lost?" And it explains the controversy, because for, you know, a black woman hasn't won Album of the Year since Lauryn Hill in the late 90s. So is there more that could be weighed in the Album of the Year category? I don't know. I got done telling Aaron a day or two ago that, you know, a song was good because it was popular. Songs get popular for a reason. And so we're not going to resolve anything here. But trust me, I'm going to pay more attention to this debate next year and actually listen to some of these albums and have a more informed take. Much more in our next hour here on Up North News Radio.